So I'd like to start off talking a little bit about what I've been working on previously, so you guys have some idea where I'm coming from with this. This time last year, I was working on something I called the Machine Space Project. It was a paper I did that was in hypertext about kind of the dialectical problems of the internet. I used this term called the mutually paralytic opposition between kind of capitalist and revolutionary forces at work on the web. And I have a new term for it now. I'm going to call it the virtual impasse, pun intended. So there's pretty much us, the people who looked at the internet when it first happened and thought, oh good, finally some democracy. Or better yet, we looked at it and said, oh good, finally some anarchy. We love that everything's possible and everything worthwhile is free. We see zeros and ones as art and philosophy and not really as commodities. And then on the other side, we have the people who really just produce technology for war and for commodifying things that were previously uncommodified. They sell us new electronics so that they can sell us more. And they did this thing where they made buying easier. They removed all sense of exchanging money for goods and services, which we've kind of been used to the point where we start to feel like we're not even exchanging money at all, but it still seems to be gone. So in the project, I start talking about things like the recodification of language, the internet as this postmodern space, sort of like what Frederick Jameson likes to talk about, where you wind up getting absorbed and lost, and that's all part of the design. That's how it's supposed to function. You can read it if you want. The important thing is the virtual impasse idea, and this is going to be an extension of that, and how the virtual impasse makes its way into sexuality, how different people react to new possibilities. We can pretty much use the internet to keep doing what we've been doing and just do it with more people more of the time. That would be them. Or we can kind of use it to completely change the way that things are done altogether, which we all know needs to happen. So since this is a gender theory talk, I feel like I really have to start with some definitions and disclaimers. I'm not going to pretend that these definitions are universal or complete, and I hope you don't have a problem with them. So gender, first of all, defining gender is always really problematic. For the purposes of this talk, when I say gender, I'm referring to the whole of what gender has come to mean in terms of our attempts to subvert the existing gender constructions. Even if we all agree that the gender binary isn't valid anymore, we also really have to address its continued import and influence on our perceived identities. We see ourselves as gendered beings in at least two ways. The one in which we uphold certain hegemonic practices, and the one in which we don't. I don't believe that Western society is really at a point right now where we are prepared to abandon binarisms completely. So we have to consider, at least to a certain extent, how even our subversive acts wind up positioned in relation to the existing structures. That said, I'm hardly going to talk about biological gender, but in case I say that, I just mean the genitals that you're born with. The other disclaimer I'll make on the same line is that I'm going to say her. Pronouns are kind of tricky, but I think it's a style choice just to refer to the gender of the speaker, author, which in my case is her. I'm not trying to exclude other pronouns. I'm not trying to privilege the experience of a her. It's a choice that I've made. I hope it doesn't bother anybody. Identity. Identity is how the individual perceives herself, her gender, and her sexuality. Parts of identity are cultivated and carefully considered, which is to say that the individual spends a great deal of time thinking about what these aspects mean for herself and for her position in society. Others are subconscious or simply hidden from view. Some are important, some aren't. I'm going to talk about how current feminist theory views the construction of identities, and I'm also going to talk about the possibility of and problems of having multiple identities rolled into one person. For my purposes, identity is mostly referring to gender and sex. Performance constitutes all those behaviors, conscious and unconscious, through which we broadcast our identity and our desires. It's not meant to imply theatricality or falsehood. The performance isn't the mask you wear, it's what you do. If you've read Gender Trouble by Judith Butler, you know what I'm getting at here. Subversion is anything we are or anything we do in an attempt to escape the confines of hegemonic practice. There are undeniable aspects of ourselves that we feel are under attack by the patriarchy, and subversion of the existing rules becomes part of identity. When I say patriarchy, I mean whatever it is that makes the rules, and when I say heteronormativity, I mean what happens when you have one man and one woman having sex for the purpose of reproduction. Real life, this one was actually pretty difficult for me. I tried to find something else to say. I didn't want to say meat space, because that just seems completely pejorative and not a good way to describe what is still a primary interface for our interaction. All I mean when I say real life is something that happens not on the internet. If you want, you can imagine the air quotes every time, since it's not always real and it's not really always life. Sexuality, the whole range of desires and preferences that people can have. For this one, I'm going to use a list that Eve Sedgwick came up with in a book she wrote called Epistemology of the Closet. It's from 1990. I think it's a really, really great list, so I will read it to you. Even identical genital acts mean very different things to different people. To some people, the nimbus of the sexual seems scarcely to extend beyond the boundaries of discrete genital acts. To others, it enfolds them loosely or floats virtually free of them. Sexuality makes up a large share of the self-perceived identity of some people, a small share of others. Some people spend a lot of time thinking about sex, others little. Some people like to have a lot of sex, others little or none. Many people have their richest mental or emotional involvement with sexual acts that they don't do or even don't want to do. For some people, it's important that sex be embedded in contexts resonant with meaning, narrative, and connectedness with other aspects of their life. For other people, it's important that they not be. To others, it doesn't occur that they might be. For some people, the preference for a certain sexual object, act, role, zone, or scenario is so immemorial and durable that it can only be experienced as innate. For others, it appears to come late or to feel aleatory or discretionary. For some people, the possibility of bad sex is aversive enough that their lives are strongly marked by its avoidance. For others, it isn't. For some people, sexuality provides a needed space of heightened discovery and cognitive hyperstimulation. For others, sexuality provides a needed space of routinized habituation and cognitive hiatus. Some people like spontaneous sexual scenes. Others like highly scripted ones. Others like spontaneous sounding ones that are nonetheless totally predictable. Some people's sexual orientation is intensely marked by autoerotic pleasures and histories, sometimes more so than by any aspect of alloerotic object choice. For others, the autoerotic possibility seems secondary or fragile if it exists at all. Some people, homo, hetero, and bisexual, experience their sexuality as deeply embedded in a matrix of gender meanings and gender differentials. Others of each sexuality do not. That's the end of her list. My last definition is sex, which for my purposes is just anything people do to get off. So what really is going on with gender identity and the internet? Do we have the internet as just a vast sexual playground that's totally separate from the world around us, where we can do whatever we want and we can ignore the implications of our online behavior? Is it a kind of terrifying post-human frontier that eventually strips us of any physical sexuality and reduces us to virtual sex lives? Does it allow us to create new identities from scratch? And if so, should we do that? And what does it mean for people whose identities have nothing to do with their biological gender, or who feel themselves drawn to subversive practices that are all but impossible to pull off in real life? What should we be excited about, and what, if anything, should we be afraid of? We get to do anything we want online, right? And that's assuming we don't get to do whatever we want in real life. The big deal, pretty much, with sexuality on the internet, as I imagine it, is that we don't have to have bodies for it at all. We can be whatever we want, we can express parts of our identities that diverge from our biology. The obvious example might be transgendered people. If you want to live as a different gender than the one you were born with, it's really easy. You just choose a different choice from the pop-down menu, and that's it. You're a man or a woman as far as the internet is concerned. And it goes farther than that. What if you don't identify with your race, your body type, your age, socioeconomic position, or nationality? You can just present as whatever you want. You can pick your own priorities. It's great, right? It's total freedom. And it's almost as if all the problems of biology, binarisms, and hegemony evaporate right away. But aren't the same structures still present? We can't simply introduce fluid identity absent biological predicates and call it a day. It doesn't work. To quote Judith Butler from Gender Trouble, she writes, "If the model of a more diffuse and anti-genital sexuality serves as the singular oppositional alternative to the hegemonic structure of sexuality, to what extent is the binary relation fated to reproduce itself endlessly? In other words, we just get a new binary. We get subversive paradigms against hegemonic paradigms. We get internet fetishists and gender benders versus everybody else, which is kind of what we have right now. The next thing Butler asks is, what possibilities exist for the disruption of the oppositional binary itself? I think we have to use the subversive paradigm to expose and eventually dismantle the old one, but I'm not really sure how to do this. I think we need to talk about the possibility of identities not predicated on biology, the questions that raises about the hegemonic structure of sexuality, and how our awareness of what goes on in the dark corners of the internet, as well as the not-so-dark corners of the internet, is already influencing the way that people think about real-life sexuality. So going back to what an internet performance constitutes, let's imagine an individual who goes so far as to identify with the body she has in real life, and we can call her Judy. When Judy gets up in the morning and she gets ready to go outside, she has some choices to make, and a lot of them are political choices, and they might all be political choices, whether she knows that or not. Does she take a shower? Does she put on makeup? Does she wear a skirt and high heels? Does she take the subway to work, or a bike, or a cab? You get the idea. She has some options, and all of them tell us something about her identity. The importance that she places on each of these choices also has a lot to do with her identity. Does Judy think it's important if she wears makeup or not, etc.? And Judy's been making the same choices every morning for years, and at this point, she probably doesn't think about most of them or about what they mean. They're all part of her identity, in that they take into account how she feels about her gender and sexuality, and she either uses these choices to reflect her feelings or uses these choices to make it seem as though she feels otherwise. She's in the system, and either she likes it or she doesn't like it. Either she tells us about it or she doesn't tell us about it. It's all part of her performance. We get a lot of information that Judy wants us to get. We probably also get some information that she doesn't want us to, and maybe we're missing some of the things that she means for us to catch on. So what happens when Judy gets to make a MySpace profile? It's a whole different set of circumstances. Now she gets to control everything, and she has a lot more choices. She doesn't have to tell us how old she is. She doesn't have to tell us where she lives or how much money she has. And all of these things are things we probably would have figured out right away if we just met her. She can talk to us however she wants to talk to us, and there's really nothing that we can do about it, because Judy's pretty sure that either we're going to like what we see or we can just move on. They're all still political choices, and we need to interpret them as such, but the point is that she has them. Judy's MySpace profile is all performance, and there's no chance of us seeing anything that she doesn't mean for us to see. The profile is orchestrated, it's calculated, we can scan for subtext or missteps, but we can pretty much assume that Judy put more intent behind every word she posted online than what she does waking up in the morning. So here's the tricky question. Which one's the real Judy? She could be lying on her profile, and maybe we even assume that she is. But now we have to ask, what constitutes lying for us? What does it mean to misrepresent? And what does it mean to represent? We even have to ask if her profile is representation or presentation. And I'm not going to get near the semantic dilemma of that's you in the picture versus that's a picture of you. I think that's a little bit separate, at least. But back to which is the real Judy. The main problem right away is that we probably want to give more credence to the version of her that we saw getting ready in the morning, since we're really hung up on a real-life interface. But what if Judy doesn't give more credence to that version of herself? And is she still lying at that point? Do we think she's lying? We went to look at the profile, so we must put some stock in that, and we must want to know what it is that Judy thinks of herself. I think we're most likely to look at the discrepancies between the two Judys and interpret them as Judy taking some kind of poetic license with her identity. I think that's usually what happens. We make these little allowances, and we forgive Judy's carving out space for something that we still read as a personal mythology and not her real identity. But I think that that's our fault, and I mean for fault to sound as accusatory as it does. So let's forget about us for a moment. The important thing is that Judy gets to be whatever she wants, and perhaps she gets to be whatever she in fact is, thanks to MySpace. I'm not expressing my total gratitude for Rupert Murdoch, and don't think I've forgotten how problematic that whole structure is, but we'll get back to that. What's this scenario actually doing for and to her, besides giving her an outlet? That she has an outlet at all isn't really what's important. 20 years ago, she could have written her autobiography, she could have written stories, and maybe she would have been satisfied with that. But this isn't just about presenting an alternate version of yourself. It's about actually becoming an identity that you don't otherwise get to be in a world, the internet, that might in fact be just as legitimate as, and maybe even more so, than real life. Because on the internet, the conversation isn't one-sided, and because Judy doesn't make her profile and stop there, because the internet is way, way bigger than the interior monologue that she's been having about her identity for her whole life. And because on the internet, there's other people and there's sex. The creation of identity in this new environment is also functioning a little bit differently than the creation of identity in real life. I kind of think of the internet and the whole social network profile creation as almost a giant Lacanian mirror stage, which for those of you who don't know, the theory of the mirror stage pretty much says that you form your identity and start creating your ideas about yourself the moment you recognize your own reflection in the mirror as an infant. You kind of half stand up for a second, even though you don't know how to walk yet. You look in the mirror and you see a version of yourself that's standing, at which point you start to become it, if that makes any sense. I came up with an analogy the first time I learned about the mirror stage, which was kind of standing in front of a mirror and sucking in your stomach and acting like what you see is actually you. So maybe the internet is really just this big mirror stage where you're putting all of this out there, and in the process of putting it out there, you're also becoming it. So I want to make another point before I get into how sex is operating online and before I answer Butler's last question. Just to keep things as complicated as possible, we've said already that there aren't bodies on the internet. That's obvious enough. So what is there instead? There's just language, which means that we have to talk about signification. The internet is all language, and it's a language that's particular to its environment, and it's different in so many ways than any other form of language we've ever seen before. It's media, and it's media that's deeply embedded in the language of the internet, surrounded on all sides by introductions, disclaimers, descriptions, comments, to a degree that's completely impossible in real life. There are specific spaces and venues for the distribution of media. There's context for every photograph, video, and sound. The rhetoric of internet interaction is pervasive, and it's almost completely impenetrable. Essentially, the body that exists in real life is perhaps replaced by a codified system of linguistic and visual signs. And by replaced, I mean specifically not to say displaced. And by visual signs, I mean that this language of the internet has all sorts of layers and the kinds of media represented and the context of media in terms of where and how much. We have two problems for signification. The first one I've already discussed to some extent, which is that given how calculated everything on the internet must be, we kind of don't get to play the same critical and psychoanalytic games of modern structuralism that we've come to rely on. You can try if you want, and you'll probably get somewhere, but you won't get nearly as far as you would if you realized that Judy, for instance, might know exactly what she's doing with the tools that she has, and her language is different from yours. The second problem is an extension of the first, and it's something that I've only really recently come across and started thinking about. And it's the idea that signification might not have to do with lack versus presence any longer, and instead it might be that we can only look at signification on the internet as a process of patterns and static, that the sign means versus the sign that means versus the millions of surrounding signs that don't. We have our filters turned up, and when we look at Judy's profile, it's not in the context of a vacuum of things we aren't looking at. It's in the context of an infinite expanse of things that we have to consciously try not to look at. But back to us, Judy's audience. What bothers us exactly about the discrepancy between the two Judys? Keep in mind, Judy isn't even an extreme example because we've cast her as someone whose online performance pretty much lines up with the one we get in real life. But imagine that we never got to see her getting ready in the morning and we don't have any access to that information at all. What concerns us is that we're not sure, looking at her profile, what she'd be like in real life, and that makes us very, very anxious. This is where, for us, it becomes a problem that she might be lying. Because we're very concerned with her real-life identity, since this is the one we might think we could encounter sexually someday. And as far as real-life sexual encounters go, the body is still pretty important. More important than that is the way that Judy fits into the hegemonic sexual paradigm. Going back to Butler, one of her main arguments in Gender Trouble is that identity and, in fact, personhood are reliant on the paradigm. Judith Butler writes, and the quotes that I'll do are her quotes, "Inasmuch as identity is assured through the stabilizing concepts of sex, gender, and sexuality, the very notion of the person is called into question by the cultural emergence of those incoherent or discontinuous gendered beings who appear to be persons, but who fail to conform to the gendered norms of cultural intelligibility by which persons are defined. The specters of discontinuity and incoherence, themselves thinkable only in relation to existing norms of continuity and coherence, are constantly prohibited and produced by the very laws that seek to establish causal or expressive lines of connection among biological sex, culturally constituted genders, and the expression or effect of both in the manifestation of sexual desire through sexual practice. It's a lot. It's a mouthful. But in other words, what she's saying is that we probably can't even read people who don't fit into the paradigm as people. People become people according to their only through their assimilation into the normative structure. And the cues that we have for reading identity are only constructed via the individual's participation in the patriarchal hegemonic system. So now we're back to what passes for identity in the first place and how identities get constructed. We all know that the gender norms are cultural fabrications, right? Most people wind up internalizing these fabrications to the point where their identities are constructed for them already by the system. Michel Foucault talks about why the patriarchy had to extend its control into the sexual realm in History of Sexuality, and all of biopolitics is about pretty much why the fabrications got fabricated. So there's plenty out there about that subject, and I'm not going to move towards that particular discussion here, but I want to bring it up because it's relevant for what goes on with social networking. Basically, all these systems exist because the powers that be have a vested interest in regulating our sexualities. We have to be productive members of society, and more importantly, we have to be reproductive members of society. And supposedly, we can't do that if our identities fall outside of the scope of coherence. So are there different definitions of coherence on the internet? And to what extent should we care whether there are or not? Because it's the notions of continuity and coherence with and to the paradigm that we're trying to dismantle, right? So we have to go after that first. We can identify, if we want, patriarchy and hegemony as the causes of all of our problems, and I think that we like to do that. Lost my place. On top of that, though, is the issue that Butler brings up, which is that we are unable to read sexualities that don't fit in, whether or not we think that hegemony sucks. So what constitutes legible sexuality on the internet? And do we wind up using the same criteria inadvertently? Do we apply the same confines and the same restrictions that the patriarchy has been so successful at getting us to apply in real life? Here's where the virtual impasse comes back, because obviously they are going to want us to see internet sexuality as analogous to real life sexuality and therefore to take the same standards and apply them. So then our goal should probably be to create entirely new definitions, right? So what would the analog be then? What is it that they have put in place to kind of extend control onto the internet? I'm going to go with internet dating, specifically paid internet dating. Internet dating helps to foster the anxiety we have about that slippery disparity between real-life identity and online identity, because it's taking everything that we know about sex, about reading people and meeting people, and it's just translating the current practices into the new interface. It's exactly what they did with shopping. And how different are shopping and dating anyway? So why are these websites a problem for us for this analysis of internet sexuality? Probably because internet dating preys upon the freedom of expression and presentation that's unique to the online world. While the matchmaking trade is anything but new, the internet provides an opportunity to expand matchmaking into uncommodified markets, just like everything else. So desire gets sold in private without the individual ever having to confront another human being, and it's the sense of privacy that winds up counting for most people, the sense of privacy. People who never would have thought to cough up all of their personal information, all their intimate beliefs about themselves and their desires, get to do so without feeling as though what they've just done, in fact, is purchased a privilege of control over who they meet and who meets them in this fairly scary interface. Online daters love their own privacy and anonymity, and they hate it as everybody else has it. So they'll pay and pay to see more of their peers. The anxiety never goes away because the dater, having paid up, feels entitled to the honesty of everybody else. And honesty then becomes so much more important because obviously what's just happened is that the users are paying for sex, or at least the promise of sex. And, I mean, the end result is the same as every other form of matchmaking. So if you've paid for something, you feel like you need to know what you're getting. So what happens is the faceless they get to keep promoting real life as the primary interface, and therefore accurate representation becomes incredibly important, and therefore misrepresentation is dangerous to the whole scheme, and nobody wants to lose their community. On that note, I'd be remiss not to address the other big reason why people are so afraid of the anonymity of others on the internet, even if they love to be anonymous themselves, which is all the times people's fears about what happens when you don't know who you're talking to actually turn out to be pretty legitimate. What I'm talking about are kids who are lured into malls by predators and things like that. I'm not legitimizing the violence that the internet winds up making possible in this regard, and I'm not really even trying to explain it. But I think that we really have to pay attention to how these instances get overexposed and how they get presented to us. There's a lot of sensationalist reaction. The fact that this potential is even there kind of caused for sensationalist reaction before it even really started happening, to the extent that it's all some people know about the internet. Some people honestly think that the internet is just this horrible, dangerous place where everybody there either gets defrauded or molested or something terrible happens. And these fears of violence and disappointment wind up getting exploited. We get sold safety software and services because we're so afraid. So we have to remember that although the fears of the general population wind up coming to life, they really do more good in selling products and maintaining control than they actually ever do in keeping people safe. To say that we have to steer clear of internet sexuality for that reason is to say that we have to continue practicing the current model of sexual compartmentalization at the whim of the patriarchy. So it's no wonder that we get bombarded with examples of how not knowing who you're really talking to lead other people into at least disappointing and at most violent circumstances. Having said that, you might be thinking, but if they're doing such a good job of scaring people, why does anybody buy in? Probably because the marketing angles are different and yet equally effective. But what about internet sexuality whose ultimate expression isn't a sex act? Why would a patriarchy who spent the last 100 or 200 years just trying to prevent subversive sex acts from happening even care about people who aren't interested in meeting up and having sex at all? Is it for the same reason that masturbation is taboo? That if we're not having sex, we're not reproducing, and we should be? I don't think it can be that simple. If internet sexuality was just about celebrating new ways to masturbate, internet identity wouldn't be quite so problematic. And in the final analysis, internet identity and all it implies for real-life interaction just winds up creating a tear in the fabric of hegemonic sexuality. But I'm not quite there yet. What we've seen is that sexual identity on the internet comes to encompass a few more factors than sexual identity in real life, or at least it plays these factors out in pretty different ways. I want to address a couple words I've thrown out a little bit ago, privacy, anonymity, and audience. I don't want to talk about the internet multitudes and all that that implies. Again, I think it's a bit of a different discussion, although multitudes is a great word and a great thing to talk about. But I want to come back to that list that we got from Eve Sedgwick at the beginning. It's a list of the variables of sexuality, and it also implies that the extent to which an individual reveals or conceals these aspects of herself And why is really just as important. So whether you answer yes or no, you know, do you say that out loud and how loudly? Later in the book, Epistemology of the Closet, Sedgwick writes, living in and hence coming out of the closet are never matters of the purely hermetic. The personal and political geographies to be surveyed here are instead the more imponderable and convulsive ones of the open secret. Going back briefly to what I said earlier about the construction of identity, we've established that there is a discrepancy between public and private identities, and that these play into performance. In public, there's two interpretations of the performance, the one that we make for ourselves and the one that's made for us. By deploying or subverting our hegemonic practices, we learn to exert a degree of control over how we are perceived, how our identity is perceived, and how our position in relation to power structures is perceived. And this control, obviously, is again a dimension of the performance. So if we engage in subversive practices or identities, do we put them on display? I'm reiterating that now because now we're talking about the display itself. What is an open secret on the internet? What happens to the individual who reveals some part of her identity online that she never reveals in real life? And we talked about this yesterday a little bit. Since I've already brought up Lacan, I'll bring up Lacan again. We've been throwing around this other concept and how it plays into sci-fi and maybe even is the backbone of a lot of sex and science fiction. On the internet, it's kind of like everybody's an other, since we don't know what's going on with the other person's body. And maybe we want to assume that this other person is lying because we like that otherness. We're immediately faced with what, under the terms of the they, is an illegible sexuality. In other words, an instant other. Do we like that? For the same reasons, we like the sci-fi other, that to us it's all just fiction. So is part of our desire to be online and to be engaging with all of these other identities really just another aspect of our kind of desire for the unknown? It's a good question. Back to the open secret, I was maybe going to talk a little bit about the internet as a confessional, and I think that that's still a discussion worth having in light of Foucault and all of his ideas about confession and power. But it's a different set of social and historical signs and circumstances that I'm not talking about. Sexuality and social networking has, I think, more than it's like a confessional, it's like putting yourself on stage and not being able to see the audience. But unlike any other venue for expression that people may have had previously, you can be pretty sure that there actually is an audience there when you're online. You don't get to pick and choose the members of your audience, which is either frightening or exhilarating or both, depending on who you are. Going back to Judy, she doesn't know who's going to look at her MySpace profile, and maybe she doesn't care. What does she decide to reveal, given the faceless mask that is her audience? Is it another facet of her identity that only comes out under this very specific set of circumstances that only the internet can provide? That the internet provides Judy with a space to act out a heretofore unrecognized dimension of her identity is an important reason why we can't just draw a simple connection or a correlation between her online and real-life performances. It's an entirely different beast. It's a whole new set of information. Maybe it's actually built into Judy's identity that she's one thing in real life and another thing on the internet. And maybe we have to add another bullet point to Sedgwick's list. Do we actually have three Judys? The real life one, the online one, and the sum total of both? Do we accept her online identity as the most faithful to how she sees herself for all the reasons I named before, that she gets to say whatever she wants, that it's a total performance, etc.? Or is her identity a combination of that which she posts on her profile and everything we saw her do getting ready in the morning? Or again, does it depend on Judy. Let's say for argument's sake that the real Judy is what she posts online. That is to say that the internet gives us something real life never could, the ability to perform an identity that has absolutely nothing to do with our bodies. And if we, as enlightened as we are prepared to abandon biology as a predicate for determining sexual identity at all, shouldn't we be absolutely thrilled to have this possibility and this opportunity? As more and more of our interactions move online, all those individuals who felt a lack of identification with their bodies get to become their real identities. And we like that, right? We want to ditch our bodies like suits that we don't feel like wearing and become internet post-humans. We can say that the body restricts the scope and import of performance. We can draw a comparison to body dysmorphic disorder, in which the individual perceives her body as other than it is. In real life, maybe for all of us, we have this sense of dysmorphia. We don't see ourselves as the politics inscribed on our bodies, and all of us at every moment are just completely covered in politics, and sometimes we don't like them. It's not even that we're inventing new bodies for ourselves, although we could do that. We're actually expressing the identities that our bodies keep us from having in real life. And a part of that identity, if a part of that identity happens to be that you don't need a body for sex, well, then it works out great for you. But I want to bring up Butler's question again, because it's still a bit of a problem. Earlier I quoted her. I'm going to repeat this quote. If the model of a more diffuse and anti-genital sexuality serves as the singular oppositional alternative to the hegemonic structure of sexuality, to what extent is that binary relation fated to reproduce itself endlessly? What possibilities exist for the disruption of the binary itself? So again, are we actually just left with a whole new binary? We still have bodies, and we probably will for a little while. We don't want to jump off the post-human deep end quite yet. Here's what I think, though. The internet has brought up all of these questions, and now that they're here, they're not going to go away. We're constantly having to ask about the discrepancies between real life and internet identities and why they matter. If gender theory has gotten us so far, to embrace the idea that gender is a social construction and that there's nothing wrong with feeling yourself a different gender than the one you were born with, and if queer theory has gotten us to accept any number of sexualities as valid, can some new thought or theory move us to a place where we can accept internet identity as privileged equally or even above real life performance? It's possible that Butler might say we still have the same problem of the legible versus the illegible, and simply calling everything legible doesn't really clear that up. What she's calling for is the dissolution of everything politics and culture do to identity, and more so everything they will do. So one of the things that I was thinking about today was we've just been kind of broadening the scope over and over again, but we've been talking about robot sex, and in a few years, when there's people who only like to have sex with robots, are we just going to have the same conversation again? You know, if in a few years we've completely accepted alternate sexualities and gender expressions, are we still going to think it's weird when there's people who have sex with robots? Probably. So basically, just bringing internet sexuality into the realm of the generally accepted doesn't clear up the fact that we still have this division between accepted and unaccepted. And Butler doesn't just want us to keep on broadening the circle. She wants there to be no circle. I don't know for sure, you know, that we won't do that, and I'm not ready to say that embracing the possibilities of the internet is just another step in line with the patriarchy that actually wants us to keep broadening the circle for whatever reason. The difference between internet sexuality, though, as opposed to what's happened with feminism and queer theory, is that it actually leaves nothing at all fixed in place. We leave open the possibility that not only is internet identity a legitimate presentation of the individual, but also that the individual might get as many identities as she wants, and that these are all legitimate. It's the tendency of hegemony to fix as many things in place as possible, even and especially if what's being fixed in place runs counter to the order. That is, if you're outside the circle, you stay there. You can't have a circle without someone being outside of it, so it's very important to establish who is outside. Part of fixing things in place is also to limit people's ability to change identities. Supposedly, this is what keeps society in order and makes it easy to understand other people. We have to have lines about what's illegible because we have to have things that are, by contrast, legible, because otherwise we can't ever get anything done, right? So if you start tearing down the lines of legibility, and if you start claiming yourself to be something other than your biology, well, that's a pretty big problem as far as the order is concerned. But, you know, all of the heteronormative notions about gender, sex, and identity are worn out and irrelevant and ready to be dismantled, including all of those things about only getting one, and the one that you get is based on your body. So if we throw them out, we wind up with anarchy in the sense that no order is able to dictate what performances and expressions are valid. There's no conformity because there aren't any more guidelines. And if our internet is a space without guidelines or constructs, then we should keep it that way.
We're perfectly in time. There's lots of room for questions.
So what do you think about the fact that people who use social networks actually present themselves in different ways on different networks? So someone might have a particular representation of themselves on a MySpace page, which is really for their friends and their peers, possibly starting in high school. Another representation on a dating site where they're looking to meet a specific type of person that's the idea of what they want. Maybe a third on a job site or on a music site or an interest site. We talked about having three real selves, but how about that fact that, in fact, there are lots of different representations of the same person that people put forward to reflect who they think their audience is or what their goal is?
Sure. Well, I think that might be a case where we really can just draw a comparison to real life, in that I'm certainly a different person at work and here than I am with my friends. And I think that they're all part of the same identity for the most part. It's just different facets of yourself. But the important thing is that in all three cases, you get to do what I've been talking about, where, you know, here's my job professional persona, and in fact, as far as the internet goes, I'm going to tweak it a little bit, and I'm going to have this one specific professional job persona. I mean, we all kind of fragment our identities based on the social situation, and I think that that happens in pretty much the same way online, but the important thing is that no matter what venue or space you're looking at, you still get to do whatever you want.
I'm not sure whether this is a question or just an add-on. All this talking about finding out whether somebody lied or didn't lie, this kind of... it is a question. I think that we don't even care if people lie at us. We never know what's going on in the consciousness of anybody that is we're facing. We're just accepting whatever he or she tells us. That's kind of a cultural technique we all no. So I have the feeling that the question of whether somebody is for real or not for real, or true or not true, only comes up when something is at stake. In other realms of culture, that's, for example, at the court. So how would you relate to that? Because I think that identity questions and the question whether somebody or something is real is not equally important in different social contexts. I think this has to do with police states and things like this, and
yeah.
Normative notions.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I like that question about what's at stake. I think that as far as, you know, who's lying on the internet, it only really matters if you're planning on doing something to that person's body in real life. And so there's nothing at stake if I'm looking at profiles and talking to people, whether their level of honesty doesn't really matter up until that point where I think it might wind up crossing over into real life. And what I'm saying though is that it shouldn't, like, ideally should never really matter. And I'm kind of trying to go after what we think of as lying, really. Because if what somebody says runs counter to their biology but in line with their perceived identity, then I don't think that counts as lying. I'm not sure if that really answers your question though.
More not so sure questions. Where?
Ah.
Thank you for the talk, by the way. It's very interesting. You said something that really caught my attention earlier when you said something along the lines of everyone on the internet being an instant other. And I thought that was really interesting. I'm not sure whether or not I agree with you, but assuming that premise is correct, do you see that changing as we integrate more interactive technology in our internet experience?
So if there's slightly more physicality to it?
If there's a way to, you know, hook up teledildonics and have video feed and sound feed as well as the text feed, then it's not just language that's connecting us to these remote people anymore.
Uh-huh.
Does that change our perceptions of their identities and our validations of their perceived identities?
Yeah, I mean, I think the little bit that you're talking about was something that I kind of wasn't planning on saying, but felt like I had to say given the sci-fi context. No, it's great, it's great. I think, it's the instant other thing happens in part, I think, because of the problems that I've kind of been attacking. That if the identity isn't legible, I mean, that's the definition of the other, right? You have this alien that you don't know how to place or nail down in the context of your worldview, and therefore it's an other. So if you assume that nobody on the internet is telling the truth about their body, and if this is in fact a problem for you, then these kind of amorphous beings that you're thinking of as, you know, bodies but not bodies, or however you want to do it, wind up becoming just as alien for their amorphousness as anything else. Right? Does that make sense? But I think that you're right, though. I think that if things do start to become more physical and we have to forge these more immediate connections right away, like we do in real life, you wind up making up your own definitions of somebody's identity the moment you meet them. Maybe the more that those lines get blurred, you know, the less of an instant other you wind up having. But it's also, I mean, you can also kind of lessen that effect if the otherness starts to diminish, you know. This guy?
You were saying how the medium of the internet and of all these sexual interactions of the internet is language. and not body. Do you think that, I mean, I was theorizing that really the avatar is a sort of body. And I mean, I definitely don't think it's language. And I mean, the same could maybe be extended to like pictures on MySpace, like where you could, you know, Photoshop your fake pictures to be the person that you want to be, you know, or the gender or whatever role you want to inhabit. Which I don't know. Do you think that that opens up like a different avenue of the sexual interaction on the internet?
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe it would have been a good idea for me to put language in my definitions at the beginning, because I'm definitely not just talking about words that you write. I kind of have this whole thing about internet vernacular and the codification of all of these, you know, these systems. Because what's really interesting to me that's happened with, you know, specifically avatars and profile pictures is that there's this whole like chain of signification that the internet has kind of spontaneously generated. You know, if you have a picture where you're going like this, you're actually broadcasting a very specific part of your identity just in having that specific kind of picture. You know what I mean? So I think that that's I meant for that, for what you're talking about, to be kind of built into, you know, language in the broader sense and the whole codified system. So
yeah, like a picture, an image, like if you send it out, it contains language. I mean, it's like the gestures, all the stuff. So that's, I think you're pretty much referring to language as like as a postmodern term, I guess. Like
right,
like avatar would use it or something like that.
Yeah, well,
everything is text in a certain way. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, there's a language of the internet, just like there's a language of the cinema. You know, it has its whole own architecture and structure and
cultural grammar, I guess.
Yeah. But, yeah. Exactly.
I'm just wondering, it seems like there's a lot of things now with the internet where things are getting connected up, and it's actually, like, you can have these different identities, but it's getting harder and harder to, like, really keep them distinct unless you very actively work to keep them anonymous. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about that or comments about that.
Like, in the same way that I guess the question earlier about if you have your, like, monster.com profile is definitely different from your MySpace profile, is
right,
that what you're talking
about? Right, and you can say, like, okay, this one is for work and this one is for my high school friends and whatever, but somewhere there's a thing that's going to say, oh, all of these are about the same person. And so
right.
People could easily track back to the others.
No, definitely. And I mean, like, just personally, as you guys can see, I have a really weird name.
Uh-huh.
And when you Google me, I'm the only person you get. So I've seen this happen. You know, like, there's no separating stuff for me because, you know, you're just going to get all of it all at
right.
once. And, I mean, I think that that kind of plays into, you know, the choices that people wind up having to make or deciding actively not to make about what gets posted on each and every profile. You know, I mean, there's always kind of been the hazard of, you know, if you go get wasted at the bar next door to your office, your boss might walk in, you know. So you have to come up with these tactics to either keep them separate or to, you know, just simply not do anything that would cause you some kind of problem if they wound up in the same room, you know. And I think, I mean, in kind of a more, maybe taking a more severe angle to it, you know, if you were, like, playing a girl on one site and a cat on another site, and somebody figured out that you were the same end user, you'd probably just have to come up with a really good explanation as to why those are both legitimate or not care, you know. And I think most people just don't care, you know.
So I had kind of a follow-up question for that. So we're talking a lot about how I project my identity as a single person, but what happens when you have Flickr and Facebook and all of these things where I don't necessarily have control over what people are posting about me? So I got drunk at the bar, my boss sees that picture, but I didn't take that picture and I didn't post that picture. So I'm just curious about what you think about that, and
yeah,
how that's starting
I mean,
to change how we are in control or out of control of that.
Right, right. Well, I mean, that's always, that's the, that's the sticky little problem. You know, you can't obviously control what your real life friends are going to say about you, or even your online friends. And, you know, that's how, I think we talked about this last night, like that's how people get outed, that's how people get fired from their government jobs for being caught on LiveJournal with a bong. I don't really have an answer for you because that's kind of not where I'm going, you know. I'm shooting more for that part of the internet that has absolutely nothing to do with real life, and I'm kind of like framing this discussion in imagining that real life doesn't matter at all, which obviously it does, you know, which is why your question is a big problem for me. But I mean, just in terms of you know, if you, I don't know, I'm just kind of trying to promote like your completely constructed online identity that you feel more in concert with than the picture of you drunk at the bar that your boss sees as somehow more legitimate and something worth paying attention to. So.
I guess I'm just sort of missing one thing here. You mentioned now the problem with being in the bar and your boss shows up as you're drunk, or somebody else running into the photo of you drunk at the bar, your boss, for example, compartmentalizing the various aspects of your personality and trying to keep them separate. And maybe it's just a cultural thing, since I guess my online socialization is, as far as the net is concerned, has taken place primarily in Europe, where I have the advantage that most of my bosses are completely clueless, and despite being a public media figure in the country that I live in, I don't really, I basically have to maintain sort of a general personality that goes all the way across when I go out in public and when I'm on air and when I'm online. But I just don't get the feeling that, at least in Austria, I'm going to get fired for what happened in the bar the other night. But it really seems to be an issue with what's going on in the States as far as their, I don't know. I'm just sort of lost as to why this is such a massive problem, basically.
Long way from Minnesota.
I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because I don't think it's nearly as big of a problem as everybody tries to say that it is. It's kind of this hanging hypothetical. I think, you know, I think it's this hanging hypothetical that people use as like, oh God, don't post that picture, don't say this, because you never know who might see it. You know, number one, I'm, you know, not personally afraid of that, and I think that if I was, I would just, you know, make some different choices. But what I'm trying to say is that I think when the more that people reinforce those fears, you know, the more of a problem it is for those of us who don't care and would really just rather carry on these online identities that are more successful at expressing who we are.
Is the fear greater with shall we say, older people and less prevalent than with the younger?
In
the States, at least?
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, first of all, I don't think that older people, at least in the States, engage in social networking nearly as much. Certainly not enough for that to be a problem. You know, so it's not as if you know, my mom has a MySpace profile that she's afraid her boss will see. God, I hope not. But I think that
why?
Why do I hope not?
As a dad, I have to ask, who has a MySpace profile?
I'm not afraid that my mom has a MySpace profile. I would be afraid of her having a MySpace profile that would be such that she would be afraid that her boss would see it.
Why?
Because that would imply something about my mother that I'm not willing to accept.
Do She did have sex before.
I know that.
I don't mean to destroy any illusions you might have.
Anyway, separate issue. My mom's probably going to listen to this too.
I mean, I think the issue is not so much like I'm, you know, is my boss going to see a picture of me drinking? It's more likely I will post pictures of my boss drinking. But it's more a question of if you're trying to, you know, display an identity for the purpose of playing with identity that is not your real identity, and you want to keep that separate from your real identity, and then you get people coming on saying, this is not you, I know you, blah, 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 that kind of thing. And it's not like, oh, I'm going to get fired or whatever. I'm just curious about how, you know, you, because that imposes then on into that identity that you're trying to build or create.
Right. But I think, I mean, I think that's as much a, I mean, the answer to that, like, let's say, you know, you're if you're posting as somebody else online and you've got this whole construct built up that you identify with much more than who you are in real life, and your friends say, hey, I saw your profile and you're totally lying, at that point, the only acceptable answer is, yeah, fuck you. Because, you know, if there's a problem with your biology that's not something that you have control over in real life, I think that, you know, the great thing about the internet is that it's finally giving you back your agency over your identity. And there's always going to be kind of political complications with that, just the same as there were, you know, with any other kind of subversive behavior. You know, when your parents say, hey, stop being gay, the answer is, yeah, fuck you. And I think it's kind of the same situation. So, you know, there's no better answer for that, and I'm sure it's difficult, you know, when everybody figures out that, you know, you have this secret online furry identity and they go nuts, the only answer is fuck you.
So, if you want to rob a bank, you shouldn't Twitter it.
Yes. Yes.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
May Sessler, wonderful talk.